Okay, welcome everyone to Konstanz. I think this is the nicest workshop I've ever done, and we haven't even started yet. I'm really, really happy that you're all here. It's bizarre to see all those faces in a small town bordering Switzerland, and I never thought I ended up here, and now you're here. So it's amazing, and I'm so happy you came from wherever you're based. And boy, I mean, we haven't been in touch for a long time. Your Facebook is just not enough, and I just realized that yesterday evening. So welcome everyone once again. Here at the Bischof's Villa at the Seerhein. This house is an 18th century building, part of a whole cluster of institutions here at the university, which came out of the Cluster of Excellency. It's funded by the Cluster of Excellence, and it has allowed people like Madeline to stay here and do nothing but write.
Do nothing but write.
So it's a very luxurious institution in that sense, but it's also down to earth, and there are lots of interesting things going on here. And it's a small place, as you can see. So we were thinking of how to make it bigger, because there are so many people who cannot attend. And I got a lot of emails, and I think Madeline too, of people saying, this is such a great thing, and I'm sorry, I can't come, and I wish I could come. And so, we thought, okay, how can we broaden the audience? And since we're all more or less interacting with people all the time, we thought, okay, we should videotape this and make it available to whoever is interested in the discussions and the panels. And we have to think of where to put these discussions. One obvious choice for me is Allegra, of course. There are other possibilities, Central Asian outlets probably, but the idea is really to provide an opportunity for everyone who's interested in Central Asia to take part in our discussions and to participate. Having said that, there are two practicalities. You've all got the program in front of you. You've all filled out this form. There's a reimbursement form. If someone doesn't have that, I can hand it over later. Please try to fill it out while you're here and give it back to me or Madeline, because this will speed things up in terms of reimbursement. And I don't need any original tickets, but only those people who will get a reimbursement of their travel costs will need to provide their flight ticket or train ticket. But just bring it here tomorrow. I'll make a copy and you can keep the original. All right, I think we can start with the first panel. And we'll make way for the panelists. So
great, so this panel, we have the double confusion of being a Timothy and a Tim and a Madeline, and then we're discussing books by Bota, Christian, and Judith. So this is going to get really sort of like, whoa, got complicated. Would either of you like to kick off with some comments, or I can kick off with comments, any preference?
I'm happy to begin.
Go for it.
So
I've written some prepared comments, and I'll read from those, and then obviously things will get more informal later. Firstly, I'd just like to thank Madeline and Judith for their invitation to Konstanz. This is a format that I'm really excited about, and I'm very much looking forward to the exchange of ideas today and tomorrow. And secondly, I'd like to thank Judith again, but also Bota and Christian for writing three books that I think are really terrific, and I hope will serve as a useful jumping off point for getting at some of the meatier methodological issues and issues that touch on all of the books here in our discussions. So where I'd like to start is the recognition that probably not all of you have read all three of these books. And indeed, in your instructions to us over the summer, Judith suggested that we begin our remarks with a brief précis of what you understand some of the core arguments or contributions of the text to be. So rather than trying to do a deep dive at first, I'm going to attempt something much more modest in my opening comments, which is to simply provide a summary of what I understand the argument of the book to be, and then to try to juxtapose them. So what this may lack for in depth, I hope it'll make up for in clarity, and it will at least sort of bring us up all together on the same page. And so I'll start with Bodo's book, Despite Cultures, then move to Christian's book, Macht der Unordnung, and then finally turn to Judith's The Force of Custom. So beginning with Bodo's book, Botha started her book, at least as I understand it, as an investigation into the study of courts and the justice system in Soviet Tajikistan, in early Soviet Tajikistan. And she wanted to use the history of the justice system there as an avenue to engage debates about colonialism and mobilizational states that scholars like Adib Khalid had raised a decade earlier when critiquing and engaging with books by Douglas Northrop, some of this generation of scholarship that I think many of us read about 10 years ago. Indeed, in this regard, Botha's work is similar to that of Christian's, who takes Adib Khalid's broad intervention and then tries, I see, to use a specific sector of state building, water rather than justice, in order to dig into that debate and to try to ask, you know, is Central Asia a colony? Is it something else? What are the best categories to use to describe places like Tajikistan or Uzbekistan in the 1920s, 30s, and in Christian's case, 40s? And yet, as I read the book at least, Botha quickly ran into a problem in her research process, but one that faces, I think, all historians who work in Soviet archives. This is, what do you do with the impenetrable language of Soviet documents? What do you do when you work with sources that seem laden with cliches? What do you do when you work with sources that are marked with what Alexei Yurchak dubbed hypernormalization, this kind of Soviet language? Botha's response to this is to regard this so-called hypernormalization, this Soviet language, not so much as an obstacle to understanding Soviet practices of governance, but rather as a practice of governance itself. As Kasim Bekova writes, a scarcity of material resources and a surplus of cultural difference shaped the early Soviet system of governance. And yet for the Bolsheviks, it was theoretically impossible, in Marxist theory, that differences between cultures could be so great as to prevent backwards nations like Tajikistan from making the leap to socialist modernity, from making the same leap that had already been accomplished in places like Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and so on. And yet without a mass political base in Russia, much less in former Tsarist colonies like Bukhara, the territories that became Tajikistan, the Bolsheviks were forced very quickly to rely on personalistic rule, whether through Central Asians with often very dubious pre-revolutionary political histories, or later, more properly, Soviet Central Asian cadre. But these new commissars engaged in score settling, personal enrichment, and theft, all the things that we're not supposed to do during the panels. And yet the language of socialism, this kind of hyper-normal language, provided a way for these cadres to speak and to describe their actions, often very immoral actions, as if Tajikistan was well on the way to socialism. A socialism defined by democratic centralism, not personalism, and the Communist Party, again, not this sort of arbitrary localized rule. So in Botha's account, this form of governance, despite cultures, and here's the title of the book, produced the Soviet language discussed earlier. It also produced and helped accelerate violence as a form of rule. Violence didn't require any sort of specific, didn't require, well, we'll get into that more. So this language about the construction of socialism that ignored this personalistic rule could be redeployed across the Soviet Union in Tajikistan as much as Ukraine. Great. And the same was true of violence as well in Botha's account. Violence, she argues, aimed to compensate for the absence of a common cultural language. Even as governance, despite cultures, did promote the use of Russian as a language of literal inter-ethnic communication, the Soviet system, as she argues as I read it, failed to create deep norms of justice, rights, obligations, etc., beyond those fixed in the official language. Violence became sort of the way of resolving these disputes for lack of a sort of deeper system of common norms. So more broadly, as I see it, Kasim Bekova's response to these earlier debates about empire versus mobilizational states is to sort of avoid them altogether and to say these are sort of artificial categories. We don't want to look at the Soviet Union as imperial or mobilizational. Rather, her move is to frame it as a state based on personalistic rule and techniques of language and violence that sought to overcome cultural difference. Yet as she hints towards the end of the book, this reliance on personalism and standardized discourse, rather than perhaps deeper attempts to root the system into these formerly colonial territories, would eventually make the Soviet Union almost ungovernable. As in later decades, the personalistic rule system becomes very difficult to uproot, and there is a lack of a sort of common set of norms. So to perhaps oversimplify the book, Botha's, I think, is a book that portrays the Soviet Union in Central Asia very much as a weak state, not a totalitarian government, not a strong, all-powerful state, but one that's rather built on a very shaky combination of personalistic rule and a lack of deep norms, with Marxist-Leninist language and Soviet language papering over the differences. So that's Botta's book. Christian Teichmann's book, Macht der Unordnung, starts from a very similar moment in the historiography of Central Asia, but he comes to different conclusions about the nature of Stalinist rule and the Soviet system writ large. Using Uzbek and Russian archives to examine the history of irrigation and agriculture in Uzbekistan and to some extent southern Tajikistan, Teichmann also rejects the binary terms of an empire versus mobilizational state debate. Instead, he argues that the defining trait of the Soviet state was its production of disorder, or unordnung. Disorder became the Soviet state's most important instrument of securing its rule, he writes in the book. And yet, as with Kasymbekova's focus on personalistic networks and techniques of rule despite cultures, there's a catch here. Disorder serves as a means of state building in Teichmann's account. But the power of disorder, he writes, perpetually undermined and destabilized the state's exercise of its power. So in both accounts, we have a kind of Soviet Union as weak state, but it's not so simple as that, really. So beyond its tight empirical contribution, again, relying on a lot of Russian archives, but also Uzbek sources, which I found very impressive, Macht der Unordnung is also a reflection on how we should write about the state and the totalitarian or non-totalitarian character of the Soviet Union under Stalin. And as I see it, Teichmann here makes two crucial points. Firstly, he explains, even as we have access to reams of material from the Soviet state, the Communist Party, and to some extent for scholars of the Western Soviet Union, the KGB as well, it's crucial not to fall into easy assumptions about the unlimited power of the state just because we have access to more and more of these archives. As I see it, Teichmann is trying to convince us and remind us that we should not mistake more documents quantitatively of state power for more evidence and qualitatively for the depth or reach of state power. The Soviet state, Teichmann stresses, was very limited in its ability to mobilize violence and resources onto one point of or one piece of territory. And for example, I particularly enjoyed his focus on so-called people's construction sites in the Vakhsh Valley in southern Tajikistan and Karakalpakstan in western Uzbekistan as examples of the limited power of the Soviet state to mobilize, punish, and extract labor from its citizens. Soviet institutions could deport citizens to such sites to build socialism in the forms of canals or cotton plantations. But many people simply ran away. And often the KGB required nearly as many agents as laborers on the ground to actually realize its projects. So that's the first point. The second major point that I see Teichmann's book is engaging are bigger debates about the character of the Soviet state with reference to thinkers like Hannah Arendt. He rejects viewing Stalinist Central Asia as a kind of hydraulic dictatorship, to evoke the terms of Karl Wittfogel. But he's also skeptical of Hannah Arendt's assumption of the Soviet Union as a totalitarian regime, rather than a regime based on arbitrary rule. For Arendt, neither Nazi Germany nor Stalin's Soviet Union could be based on arbitrary rule by a tyrant, but rather the self-conscious application of historical laws, whether of endless racial struggle or historical materialism. But Teichmann disagrees with this. He argues that we have to see the Soviet Union as what Arendt would have indeed dubbed a mere tyranny, that is, a state based on arbitrary rule, not this kind of application of historical laws. As he shows at the end of his book, the planned main Turkmen canal that would have routed the Amudarya to the Caspian Sea was carried out largely just on Stalin's whim and was only canceled when he died. It's really based on a one-man kind of system. So I think one productive line that we might take up this morning is how Teichmann's and Kasymbekova's cases for a personalistic, disordering, or perhaps simply weak Soviet Union in Central Asia contrast with one another. And here, too, I think we might profit from contrasting those tensions with earlier scholarship by people like Northrup, Adrian Edgar, or Deep Gleed in his essay on Empire and Modernizing States. If both Christian and Botta buy the argument that they're making a case for a weak Soviet Union, is that different from the kind of strong or weak Soviet state that we see in an earlier generation of scholarship? So finally, turning to Judith's book, The Forced of Custom. Beyer's book differs from Kasymbekova's and Teichmann's in its methodology. Rather than focusing on the archives in Moscow, Dushanbe, and Tashkent, Beyer conducted ethnographic fieldwork in the villages of Aral and Ingles in Talas province in northern Kyrgyzstan. But as the title of her panel, Ordering, suggests, it also shares concerns about how the Soviet experience shaped the lives of ordinary people in Central Asia. The focus in Beyer's book is salt, which we can roughly translate as custom. To stress, Salal is different from the codified written laws issued by the Kyrgyz state or Islamic Sharia. But rather than trying to merely document what salt means in some kind of cataloging move, Beyer is interested in what she calls customization. That is, how actors declare certain actions to be according to salt, according to custom. Or how actors demand patience according to salt. Or how they relate these invocations of custom to the state laws and to their own sense of selves as Muslims. And a picture is worth a thousand words, so I think just to get a sense of this, if you look at the cover of Judith's book, which, as I understand, she took herself, here we have a good example of this, of this man driving the car with both a Kaaba, the Kyrgyz flag, and a traditional talisman dangling from the car's rearview window. So all three of these sort of normative systems existing in the same frame. Here there are perhaps connections with, as I see it, Bota's argument to claim that there is not a deep sort of Soviet rooting of norms, although perhaps she would disagree with that. So to an impatient historian, this might seem like much ethnographic detail to swallow all at once. But to turn back to Teichmann's critique of stereotypes of the Central Asian state as a kind of Jim Scott modernizing state run amok, Beyer's book, I think, also connects very in a valuable way to debates about ordering. Her book shows how local actors not only protect themselves from the state, but also how they can latch onto its resources, how they can use its resources and governing practices to legitimize their own localized claims. The case that spurred Beyer into her research agenda in the first place, as I understand it, were reports of local Aksakal courts relying on salt to sanction the stoning of criminals in Kyrgyzstan. But as her research shows, such cases, whether real or apocryphal, reflect a post-1990s move by the Kyrgyz government to sanction Aksakal courts as the proper jurisdiction for family law, property law, and torts. And since 2006, the role has been secured in the Constitution. So this isn't just about people protecting themselves from some kind of totalitarian or authoritarian regime, but rather one in which the state is unloading responsibilities onto local actors. And indeed, Beyer finds Aksakal courts often imitating the language of the state and the practice of state courtrooms. And when religious authorities in her book bristle at the frivolous spending habits that Salt enjoins on its subjects, the imams rely not purely as Sharia as the basis for the reasoning, but rather imitate documents produced by the governor of Talas province. So rather than, you know, just simple models of resistance, we have a world of counterfeits, frauds, imitation, and so on that I found very rich. Reading these accounts, one wonders whether these processes of adaptation and imitation are not the same as those that Kasim Bekova sees in the personalistic systems of rule forged in Tajikistan in the 20s and 30s. And while Beyer's Kyrgyzstan is fortunately not in the business of intentionally disordering the lives of its citizens, maybe disputed, one sees parallels with Teichmann's emphasis on a weak Central Asian state. Indeed, Beyer is skeptical of the term post-socialist at all for the reason that few of her informants in Talas seem to have seen the Soviet state as deeply intrusive in the way that people in Ukraine or Russia might have depicted it, although there are emphases on collectivization as a major turning point there, but not 89, 90, 91 as a big turning point. And indeed, they don't seem to see the end of state socialism as a cataclysmic rupture in their life histories. Instead, they see themselves as dwelling in a world permanently ordered by custom, although what custom even means is always linked with the rule of the state and Islamic law, whether those were those of the Soviet state and the Sadhu Muftiat system, or those of independent Kyrgyzstan today. So just a couple of closing ideas. One, what exactly is different between Beyer's account and the world of the 1970s if people in Aral and Engels do not see the Soviet system as cataclysmic? I wonder, and perhaps for future research agendas, the 70s and 80s as a period just in general, but also if people don't seem to view the late 80s as having been particularly important even, the need to delve into that more. Secondly, does customary law form an exception to the weak state approach that I see in Christian's and Bodakos's work? As Judith notes, customary law was outlawed in Kyrgyzstan in the late 1920s, and it would appear in some ways to maybe form an exception, although, of course, as Boda's work reminds us, local actors were constantly using the language of Marxism-Leninism to reimpose their own frames of ordering. And indeed, throughout, are notions of strong or weak states even useful for us? I certainly consciously recognize the artificiality or perhaps the binary use of that term in my own presentation right now. But I think what's important is that we start using regional comparisons and inter-regional comparisons within states. Is Talas different from Jalalabad? is Kyrgyzstan different from neighboring parts of Tajikistan in meaningful ways? And so I hope that sort of the context of this forum will allow us to do that, moving beyond these kind of ideal types and thinking about ordering in a specifically regional context. So thank you for your attention, and thanks to Boda, Christian, and Judith for offering great food for that.
Thank you. Tim, do you want to?
Thank you, Timothy. I mean, I can rest the case right now. And
coffee break.
First of all, I also would like to thank Madeline and Judith for this opportunity. And I really, when I got the invitation to this book club, I said this is something for me. I would like to copy as well for the future, because I think it's something where we can discuss our research and still put it in a larger frame. Work, and I pretty much enjoyed preparing for this workshop, and really very much looking forward to the discussion in the next days. And again, thank you for inviting me as well. What Timothy, I mean, really, this concise introduction is hard to challenge, and in many ways, I would completely agree with Timothy. For me, it was, when I went through the books, it was quite a challenge, because we have two historical works and then the anthropological one of Judith. So in the beginning, I realized there's a certain kind of connection with this question of order, disorder, how people make sense out of their surrounding, and I pretty much also liked Botha's approach with this language that basically imagines known reality, the socialist kind of language. And then with Judith's ideas about salt and the fluidity, and what Timothy said about the comparison, this is Taras. My own family comes from Nokat and from Chonkei Min, and discussing these categories and issues with them.
No way.
They do it perhaps, but we don't use it this way. There are some differences. For instance, Christian takes much more time to introduce him to the topic. He has a larger historical approach to this. He's perhaps even a little bit more interested in theoretical issues, which, when it comes to the description of history or how to analyze it. What is interesting here that we have a whole range of small case studies that shows this dynamics. Timothy has already kind of explained, and we will see in both books. There are issues where I would sometimes, because when you have this personalistic account and you look at Shaduns, Rahim Boyev, and in Christian's case, a couple of engineers who implemented this, sometimes I miss this. What kind of people were they? I mean, we have very little idea. And of course, when you look at the archives, you don't get this personal information, and you don't have letters. You don't have perhaps diaries and these things. But that is sometimes a little bit like the missing link in this case, that when you have this personalistic account, you would like to know much more about their background. How did they come to Tajikistan or to Uzbekistan? What were they? What is their background? And Christian, once in a while, says very clearly, we don't know why he ends up there. And that is, of course, something where we perhaps have a kind of future research agenda to look for their diaries and these things. Okay, then leave it there. I think we should develop the discussion later. Judith's work is, I mean, the interesting point, that is something, because we talk about the future of Central Asian studies, and that was something that was still on my mind when I read through it. As far as I can see, both of you did your work in Eastern European history, is it right? Yeah? Christian as well. So, I mean, it's a very German thing that Central Asian studies in Germany is very weak, institutionally, but also as a subject. When you look at the major kind of academic associations in Germany, it's somewhere down there. I mean, for instance, right now, next week, I think, is the German, the DAVO Congress and the Deutsche Orientalistentag in Jena. And when you look at the panels over there, Central Asia doesn't really take place. It's not there. When you look then into Eastern European history, and I think Christian and Botha, you will perhaps support this, Eastern European history has this idea that the Soviet Union extended into Central Asia. But in order to make a career, you perhaps need to again look at Russia proper, or you need to look at Eastern Europe. Do you have a postdoc project right now, Christian, or what?
Russia proper.
Yeah, because I mean, the Israeli once said the East is a career, but this is not the case for Eastern European studies. I mean, you is, and I mean, in Freiburg, for instance, we have Eastern European history with Neutatz. Julia Obertreis, you know, she also did her work on irrigation in Uzbekistan and cotton growing in Uzbekistan. She got now the position for Eastern European history in Erlangen-Nürnberg. But at the end of the day, when you venture in Central Asia in Eastern European studies, at the end of the day for your postdoc or for your dissertation, depending, you need to return to Russia proper. And that is a challenge, of course, when you look at area studies as such. That is, I think, a very German thing, but this might be also something we need to discuss here. In my own subject, Islamic studies, which, of course, for an Anglo-Saxon university model is even more bizarre, because you would put us in a divinity school, you would not like to be in a divinity school, and at the end of the day, we have the same kind of methodological and career issues like Eastern European history, because with Central Asia in Islamic studies, you can't really win enough credits to base your career exclusively on this. And that is, but at the end of the day, this is a challenge we face constantly, that Central Asia, at least in a German academic environment, is rather the periphery of the periphery. And that is a challenge to us. The Force of Custom was a great book, again, because part of my family is from Kyrgyzstan, and my wife and I, we have a kind of silent agreement that we don't talk academically about Kyrgyzstan. And I read the book in my office, so I didn't bring it home. This is a joke. No. I brought it home, and my wife started to read. And she said, no, you know, in Nokat it's very different. And perhaps that is a challenge. I had this discussion already yesterday in the evening. And what I also, from my background as somebody in Islamic studies, really appreciates, and where I definitely have to say we have benefited from ethnographic work on Islam and on Central Asia, and my main research is focused on Iran in recent months again. We have definitely benefited and it really advanced our categories, our interpretation of, for instance, the Iranian society or the Central Asian societies by this very strong anthropological output we have seen in recent years. This is a major shift. When I started to study, anthropology was like a small subject, and at that time on Iran, for instance, you could find a few studies on nomads in Iran. But in recent decades, I would say in the last two decades roughly, we have seen that there's a consistent research agenda looking at various spheres in society which are approached through the lens of anthropological research. And what I also liked in Judith's work is this very strong kind of connection between theoretical reflection and the empirical data, which then also makes this perhaps this danger of being too incidental or too localized in Taraz or Nokat or where else in Tajikistan, where you then can see, this is how it works, and the fluidity in this and the categories, how people make sense out of this. This was very interesting for me to see. And in general, I think this anthropological research is now, I mean, it's perhaps when you look at Central Asian studies, the dominant methodology. I don't know what you, I mean, when I look at, for instance, when it comes to Islam in Central Asia, it's mostly done through an anthropological lens. I mean, few historical works, but most of the stuff is done with anthropology. And what I would like to take out of this workshop, perhaps here, is to listen to your discussion, I mean, among the anthropologists in here, how you will advance it. Because I still see, to some extent, this question of, is it incidental what I read there? Is it like really limited to Talas? certainly when we come to the Aksakal courts and to this general tendency in Tajikistan of this, I would say, multiple traditions they try to implement right now to control, contain, mobilize on the local level. We have this Tengriism, we have then this return to a more normative idea about of Islam. Then we have this this implement. I mean, and how this is on the local level negotiated and transformed. This was really interesting for me to see, and I would like to see whether we can then continue this discussion, and what we have learned so far. I mean, where we stand now in this anthropological research, and what will be there the from there where we will continue. And perhaps what I see, and this is not necessarily Yudit's work, but sometimes what I realize is this historical dimension. For instance, this very notion of salt. I mean, you mentioned, I think, the 1970s and 80s as this kind of blank space, the Brezhnev years, the late Brezhnev years, and this transitional time before Perestroika. Also for Tajikistan, where I dealt mostly with, this is really, we have very little kind of interpretation analysis on this time. And for me, it would be interesting to see how, for instance, things like salt would have been negotiated at that time, yeah, from an historical perspective. And sometimes this, I'm missing this, that we have this, we have this tradition, and this is something which has only been discussed in recent years, and I don't believe it to this extent. And it would be interesting to have a larger kind of research agenda looking into the kind of development of these terms. But now I think, Madeleine, will you continue?
Thank you. Yes. Gosh, well, you've both kind of opened up, I think, so many interesting issues that I would already love to leap in and talk about around the 70s and 80s, around the kind of the place of Central Asian studies within the kind of configuration of academia. I think these are all really interesting questions, and I hope they're things that we return to in the discussion. What I wanted to do in my comments, and I'm conscious of wanting to allow enough time for us to open up the discussion, and I'm sure the authors of the books probably want to respond to the things they've heard as well. What I want to try to do is just draw out some of the, I think, sort of interesting conversations that are opened up when we hold these texts together. And perhaps what I'd also like to try to do is to, in a sense, use one text as a mirror to ask questions to the other text. The reason for putting these books together on this panel, as Timothy and Tim have mentioned, two historical texts, one anthropological text, is that even at sort of face value, even on, in terms of their titles, they produced a sort of interesting a difference of emphasis. So Christian's book about the power of disorder, or disorderliness, or disordering, contrasting with Judith's emphasis on the force of custom, custom as a kind of ordering category. And I think these things are kind of an interesting tension between the texts, and I think very interesting and complementary ways. So some of the things that I think are opened up when we hold these texts together. One is, I think that all three texts do a really interesting or reveal in interesting ways the insights that come from an actor-centered approach. From very different ways, but they're all, I think, sort of writing against the kind of grand narrativization, either of how we think about the Soviet system. Was it simply a modernizing project? Was it an imperial project? That story gets really complicated when we focus on the individuals and how they have to navigate power. It gets complicated when we focus on the water engineers. It gets complicated when we focus on the lawyers who are trying to interpret Soviet rules in remote Tajikistan. And it gets complicated in the present when we focus on the role of Aksakals in navigating a law that comes from Bishkek. So I think all of these texts do a really good job in a sense of complicating grand narratives or broad sort of sweeping theoretical claims about understanding the Soviet Union as a totality or post-socialism as some kind of totality through their focus on individual agency, individual action. And it, I think also, and I think this is a particular insight of Wojtek Wuz's book, allows us to kind of, I think, move away from perhaps some of the overdetermination of normative questions, which tend to get immediately invoked when we think about the Soviet experience in Central Asia in terms of perpetrator and victim, power and resistance. Like, where is, you know, the kind of easy assumption that we can say, you know, that this Russian who was sent from Moscow was the sort of, this is the location of power, and we have the indigenous population that is the site of resistance. It really complicates these narratives. And right at the end of her book, Wojtek makes this point quite explicitly. I wanted to quote, if I can find the quote. But maybe I don't have the quote. Oh well. But this lovely sort of a comment about that we can't see the Soviet officials that she's looking at. talk about being put on the spot. I seem to remember it was right at the very end. Situating Soviet, this is the very last sentence, situating Soviet officials in the center of the analysis, this study attempts to highlight their ambiguous position as both perpetrators and victims of the regime, that they were literally made and chose to embody, right? So it's the victim and perpetrator, but it's also, where is agency in this? The kind of perpetuating things, but also a system that also produced you, that you reproduce through your actions. And I think that is a really important, I think, insight for all of us in our field in terms of, I think, the tendency that we're very often put on the spot, you know, was the Soviet experience in Central Asia a colonial experience? Is the post-Soviet predicament also a post-colonial predicament in Central Asia? And that these questions, I think, are often overdetermined by certain normative assumptions about where sort of who in that analysis is victim, who is perpetrator. So that's the first thing that I want to emphasize. And related to that, I think that perspective on personal agency opens up a kind of a possibility to really probe questions of agency and constraint. What sphere of action was there? What sphere of action is there for a contemporary Aksakal in Talas? What sphere of action is there for an elderly lady in Talas not to go to a funeral, right? And there's something about the sense in which actors, and this isn't just actors in these texts, but all of us, in a sense, are constrained by the systems, the social systems in which we live and which recognise our humanness, which recognise our personality, so that we kind of both have action to move, but we're also constrained by these systems. And I think that allows a real insight, for instance, into how it is that certain practices come to be reproduced, practices that might strike us as absurd, as irrational, and so on. And again, that kind of focus allows us to question certain normalizing accounts that, for instance, would see in practices of ritual excess simply a demonstration of a lack of restraint or a kind of irrationality, right? Both on the part, we see this on the part of political leaders making these kinds of observations, but we also see it from analysts when they write about ritual feasting as a demonstration of a sort of tendency towards excess within Kyrgyz culture. Actually, that really is questioned when we really focus on the kinds of constraints that people face in their daily life, and the way in which acting, for instance, according to SALT, becomes a way of being recognised as fully human within a community. So I think that there's something about that focus on agency and constraint that is also very illuminating. Third, another thing I think that comes across when we hold these texts together is the importance of really looking at local specificity. I mean, one of the things that I learned a great deal, particularly from reading the two historical texts, which I'm an anthropologist by training, so I was more on sort of unfamiliar territory here, was just how much the kind of the material constraints of trying to introduce irrigation in Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, how much that was constrained by the material physical properties of the land that people were dealing with, the kind of constraints of reaching particular locations, the degree that it made a difference whether we're talking about mountains and lowlands. And I think if we're thinking more broadly about our field, there can often be a sort of sweeping generalizations about Central Asia or about any of the Central Asian states. In the case of Judith's work in Talas, we can see how two different villages, two neighboring villages, had quite different experiences of collectivization and decollectivization. So this emphasis on what emerges when we really foreground the kind of local specificity. Fourth, I think that what these books do in interesting ways is really encourage us to reflect in interesting ways on conventional modes of periodization, both when we think about the Soviet period and indeed the pre-Soviet period, and when we think about the period of, quotes, transition, the post-Soviet period. And I think it really opens up, if we think about, you know, coming back to Tim's point about I think you have this lovely expression, Central Asia is a doubly marginalized field or a double periphery. But when we look at kind of what are the significant historical moments, what are the moments that get memorialized, what are the moments that were genuinely transformative for ordinary lives, they can really disrupt and unsettle some of the periodizations, the conventional periodizations that we operate with when we work on the grand scale of the Soviet. And I think that is something, again, that is very instructive for our field. In the conclusion of her book, Judith makes a great point, and I think it's a really important point, about the tendency, for instance, in a lot of anthropological writing to take 1991 as a kind of narrative starting point, that this was the moment the Soviet Union collapsed, and therefore, you know, it's sort of taken as read that this is where we begin. History sort of began again at this moment. And actually, if you look at the points that sort of matter for Judith's informants, it wasn't about 1991. It was the point at which the kolkhoz became reconstituted, or the point at which a new currency was introduced and so on, or the point at which there was a new presidential election in Kyrgyzstan. And these, I think, if we really focus on what our informants are saying about the moments that matter to them, it can, I think, complicate these stories in interesting ways. And that perhaps, for instance, the 70s and 80s, 70s in particular, until the point of perestroika, which was so often characterized in the literature as a period of stagnation, from the perspective of Central Asia, is in fact one of the greatest periods of transformation. And I'm sure we'll hear more about this when we come to discuss Timothy's book. So at that point, I'm just going to end with a couple of questions that I'm going to kind of just throw out there for the authors to respond to if they want, or just to kind of open up a discussion. One of the things that I really appreciated in Christian's book is this emphasis on the tension between a plan and arbitrariness. And there's this legality and caprice at one moment. This is my translation from my very elemental German, and anybody who's seen me reading this book will know that I had to translate sort of every fourth word. But I'm going to translate this as legality and caprice. But I think that sort of tension that illuminates is really, really generative. That we're talking about a state that is, quote, simultaneously strong and weak, penetrating and superficial, obsessed with regulation and chaotic. And then later on, this is on page 242, we learn about kalkulierten Unsicherheit, which I'm translating as calculated insecurity. And I think this is a really interesting concept. But I would kind of like to sort of push you a little bit, Christiana, or really open up that question about in this realm of arbitrariness, how much should we see the arbitrariness simply as the moment at which the desire to order a social environment in the light of a Soviet project meets an empirical reality, and then the arbitrariness and the caprice and the violence is a sort of is a response to that intersection between desire and concrete reality that you're facing. And how much was it a deliberate production of insecurity? How much was the kind of this willfulness and this caprice a very deliberate strategy of rule? So I'd like to kind of hear more about how that tension plays out. Borta, there's so much in this text that I loved. I really loved your attentiveness to language, and there's so much in this text that's so playful. I mean, in a really positive sense, that it's so the kind of wonderful little examples that you give of the point at which somebody calls out from the meeting, "Hey, you know, talk properly. We're not in America." You know, this sort of comments, and this attentiveness to the use of language, and also how language kind of for us analytically and interpretively. The limits that it produces, that we're always constrained by the language of our informants, at least when we're working with a historical archive and we can't just observe people at the same time. So that was something I would love to hear you talk more about, in a sense about the implications of taking your attentiveness to language seriously for how we think about the limits of sort of accessing questions of intent or questions of motivation. And I'd also love to hear your thoughts about the issue that Judith raises quite explicitly in her text about the need for us to rethink our periodizations of the Soviet experience, because I think there's a lot in the text that could really challenge and question the way that we tend to periodize at the Soviet experience in Central Asia. And I'd love to hear more about that, in a way about how your material speaks back to, let's say, Russian history, right, or Soviet Russian history. I think that there are some real provocations in here that could be pushed further. And Judith, I mean, I love this book, and there's a particular kind of delight in reading a book where you've sort of seen this project in development, and where we shared so much along the way. There are many questions that I'd love to ask you, but I think the question that I'll confine it to, in terms of just thinking about holding one text to another, is and it's partly the question raised by Tim as well about, I'd love to know more about the moments when Salt is resisted, and when Salt is contested, or when young people ignore it, or when it's felt to be lacking, or when it's felt to be failing. And I ask this partly as an empirical question, because in my own fieldwork in Batken region, one of the things, for instance, that I often heard in one particular village was that because it was a, quote, new village that was constituted in the 1970s, a planned village, and that families, young families, were relocated there, there was often this lament that we didn't have Aksakals. And that there was, and that this was one of the reasons why there was a sort of, there was social breakdown. In particular, that there was, in fact, a lot of tension with the between young people with neighbouring with ethnic Tajiks in neighbouring villages. And so I'm interested in the moments, because I'm very, very taken with your argument about customization, right? And about how experiences are customized, right? So that Salt isn't just this sort of unchanging thing, but it's a kind of dynamic process of rendering experience meaningful by customizing it. But I'd like to know more about the moments when that sort of breaks down, when that's kind of quite explicitly contested or resisted, or when it's felt that the figures who, in a sense, carry the moral authority of reproducing Salt are not felt to be there, you know, that where there are not only not Aksakal courts that are functioning, but the Aksakals seem to carry no moral authority in a village. So I'd love to know more about that sort of moment of breakdown. Yeah, when Salt seems not to have that force, and what that might do again for our kind of comparative reflections about understanding order and disorder in Central Asia. Thank you.